All right, this next up is somebody's out to get you legal discussion at GRC.
I'd rather be on the radar altogether.
No, but the problem is this is if it's, like, for example, if it's unattended operation, you really need to let them know, because if something goes haywire that you don't know about, the FCC needs to be able to reach you so somebody can shut down the transmitter. You know, you've got an obligation to shut that thing down in 3 hours if there's a problem.
How did you run the VGA thing? All right.
Is everybody back from... let's do 2 minutes. Let me start just until people get back from moving cars. Anybody suffered an attack yet? Tell me.
Why are people moving cars?
Oh, well, there's only 2-hour parking in the residential zone here. And so there's a state lot a couple of blocks away.
It was a friend who was unlicensed back in the day, and local people went after her.
But she was a pirate?
Yeah, she was a pirate.
Okay.
They hunted her down. What do you mean by under attack?
Under attack could be anything. Complaints to the FCC. It could be that people using the FCC's processes sometimes to attack you for problems real or imagined, or sometimes just as a harassment tool.
Yeah, I've had it.
Want to tell us about what happened?
Well, it was in the process of transferring the license from one nonprofit to the other, and there was angst about transferring the license, and so a group of people sent letters complaining to the FCC about the group, our group, that was going to be getting the license.
And what did they say?
It had to be more valid than what they were saying.
Okay. See, a lot of times, the FCC, just like any government agency, has to take in a complaint of whether the person is pointing to real regulatory issues, or even if people are mentally unbalanced, and, you know, they have to sort of acknowledge it, because that's what the government does, right? But it's a distraction. How much was your work distracted? Was it a really drain on time and resources?
It went on to be an online smear campaign that ended with a defamation suit.
Did you win the defamation suit?
Yeah, and it went around the world.
Wow. And you won, huh?
Mm-hmm.
There you go. That's the way to hang tough.
I have a quick story also. This is not an FCC issue, but we presented an Iraqi American artist with a presentation.
Mm-hmm.
The Republican mayor in Troy sent his code enforcement people to our building, and they cited us for having doors that were 2 inches too narrow after 100 years of being here. And they shut us down for 6 weeks. And, we sued them with the ACLU, and they settled out of court for the cost of the doors that they made us put in, and they matched NEA grant that we got for $50,000. So these are good things, but it was incredibly stressful.
And those are good examples of people misusing administrative processes. In one case, you would call it political bullying, right? In your case.
Very common to use code enforcement to go after political enemies.
Right. And I'm intrigued because...
My wife and I have an Airbnb, personally, that we use for the... put up guests,
mm-hmm.
and they cited us for an illegal bed and breakfast in a residential zone, one of 135 in Troy. We're the only ones now who are legally allowed to have an Airbnb. It costs thousands of dollars to go through the process. So they keep on going after us wherever they can with code enforcement.
Right, and you know, what happens is, I mean, we know that sometimes these things were used for good. After all, Al Capone was convicted of tax evasion, not of murdering people. But it can be used also as a political tool against your station. We're going to talk about some of that, and also about real problems, because sometimes stations do have real problems, and how do you try to use FCC processes to minimize the damage, and also how do you organize your stations in a way that if you are attacked, whether for real things, that you've done wrong, or just because somebody's trying to harass you because of any number of reasons, whether it's your type of programming, a political viewpoint, a particular talk show host. I mean, you know what gets people going. And so, should we go to the next? And that's a shark, by the way. It doesn't look like a shark, but it is. All right. I just talk, you know, if you came to me with the problem, what I would do as a lawyer is something you can do already. And before you start investing in legal help or any other help, how many of you have a journalistic component to your radio stations? There, we've got a couple. So, you know, the old group of W's and an H, who, what, when, where, how, and why. So figure out what facts the person's talking about, okay? First thing to do, take a deep breath. It's going to feel awful when you're getting attacked. You've worked hard. You know, you're mostly volunteer. If you're not a volunteer, you're probably not paid much money. The last thing you want is for somebody to come and start a brawl. But find the facts, and among the facts, what's the motivation of the attacker? Okay, in your case, you knew it was political, right? It was the mayor who was looking to score points with a certain group of voters, right? In your case,
it's partially political, partially the former, some members on the former board.
Right, so you have blood feuds within the family, so mm-hmm. to speak. In some, yeah.
Oh, yeah, competitive translators.
Well, I was going to get to that. It sometimes is, and that'll come, and I appreciate that, Padre. Hold the thought. Yeah. Huh? Could be any competitor. Doesn't matter if it's commercial or non-commercial, okay? We know that those of us who had mutual exclusivities and had to go to some kind of settlement or competition just to get the construction permit, you know, you may all be in a family, but you got limited resources, you know? So who's going to get the college tuition paid, right? That's what it is. So, all right. And so motives help, because then motives can allow you to focus and perhaps find a solution that doesn't involve having to defend yourself. So if it's a situation where you have disgruntled former board members, and if they're reasonable enough to talk to, maybe you could break away one of the group to rejoin the board, as an example, right? And that might shut it down, because then they'll feel represented, right? And, you know, but you know best your own situation. Is that tenable? There are some situations where there's so much bad blood and people are so irrational in their approach, and they're all about power. Yeah?
I would add community mediation.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Perfect idea. Those are resources outside. And sometimes you might find leaders in the community who do high-profile mediation, especially with something like a media outlet. So let's say there's a well-respected former mayor in the town, right, who's a lawyer. You might say, listen, can you help mediate this dispute? It's important to our community. That's, you know, that's the exact idea.
Well,
so
there's two kinds of mediators, kind of roughly speaking. One is trying to do, like, legal disputes, and they tend to do more like arbitration, and there's community mediation, which tends to be less worried about, like, forcing a solution and doing things a certain way, and tend to get more to people issues and, like, smooth things. Be sure to choose wisely for each situation.
Yeah, and in a situation like that, what you'll find is you might even find out if there are, for instance, lawyers who might be focused very often on litigious issues, but if they have a background or a side practice doing, say, divorce mediation, talk about a difficult situation, and they're very well trained, often with some psychological training and stuff, and all of those things can help. And so, yes, 10 points for Pablito. Thank you. All right. So, and then the FCC generally responds to a complaint someone has filed. And you might want to look, this is your first thing to do, look at the form of the attack. So if somebody has filed a petition to deny, say, you want to upgrade your antenna or it's time for your renewal, and somebody has filed a formal petition to deny, make sure that you were served. Just a little legal thing. If they don't serve you, you can, on procedural grounds, without even dealing with the material, petition the FCC to dismiss it because of lack of service. But you don't want to do it right away. You want it to linger out there, and then, well, you know, they were supposed to send us a copy and didn't. And so it's been 6 months. I think you have to dismiss it because they never sent us a copy. Yeah.
Yeah, for unlicensed community-based stations, that is a frequent complaint point that when the FCC shows up, they go into the potting shed, turn off the FM license, they either do serve them with a paper, with a witness, you could pop, or they don't, and just turn it off and don't turn it back on. That's the big point right there.
Yeah.
And so being served by your opposition, party A, party B, also that means you probably have ex parte, in which individuals can't talk, but only attorneys can.
Well, yeah, and I don't want to complicate this right now just because there are a couple of tricks, and I'm serious, because it gets deeper. If you get to the point where you feel beleaguered, then you look for resources to try to get some representation. You know, in some cases, you can find some pro bono, you can find cut rate, you know, there's different things. And so you look at your own resource base.
Who do they have to serve legally?
Well, if you have a listed attorney, so let's say you hire an attorney just to help you get your construction permit, they might look to see who your last attorney was and serve that person. That person is legally obliged, even if they've stopped representing you, to at least forward that to you. They might serve, if you did it all in-house, then they'll serve whoever signed it, let's say the president of the organization. But it has to be somebody who has some legal standing. And the thing is, they may not know, so they'll send it to a past president if you have a new president.
They'll send it to whoever's on your seat.
Exactly. So, you know, keep relationships up with them to make sure. And obviously, if you've had a transfer of control in the form of a board change and officer changes, make sure you filed that stuff with the FCC, not just to be compliant with the FCC's rules, which you want to be, but just in case somebody has to serve you, you don't want it to go with the guy who was ousted. And he'll just toss it in the garbage, right? He may be honorable, but, you know. So
if you change your board members, you send a letter to the FCC.
Well, there's a certain point when it's tipped 50% mm-hmm. or more, and the reason it's 50 and not 50% plus one is that the ability to deadlock is considered control. So the rule is if there's a transfer of control, then you have to just put in for a pro forma transfer of control application based on the change in board. So it's not like you've sold the station to another organization, but it's over time, and there's a whole...
Gotcha.
Michael, is it safe to say a lot of community groups and a lot of community radio stations aren't completely up on speed on that aspect?
Yes, and as a lawyer, I just have to tell people, this is what you should do, and not only to be compliant with the FCC, because over time, they make leeway for that, and you'll have a chance, say, when your renewal comes up to fix everything. But just for the reason that if somebody's attacking you, you want to get a petition to deny. Now, it may not come up because you may not have anything. A petition to deny is only filed against a formal application. Yeah?
If somebody tries to serve you, is there any reason, let's say, I come up to your door and try to serve you, is there any reason to block that?
No, it doesn't work at the FCC, because you're allowed to service by mail, and service is considered complete when the thing is dropped in the mailbox, just to prevent that. Well, you know what, there are reasons, but that's in litigation, and that's a whole other class, so hold the idea, but you're right, in part. But for the FCC, if you somebody puts a certification after a pleading, says, I served it on this person on this date, and that means you dropped it in the mailbox that day. You can drop it in the mailbox 11:59 on Saturday nights. It doesn't get picked up till Monday, but it has to be that day. Yeah?
So when I drop it in the mailbox, do they have to do it in a certified mail?
No, not for the FCC.
What if you don't have a mailbox?
You have an address.
You have an address, and you mean like you decided not to get postal mail?
Yes.
You know, we can come up with 100,000 hypotheticals. What happens if you're hiking the Appalachian Trail? Basically,
what does happen if you're hiking?
It complicates things.
Yeah. No, what it is that that's why service is considered complete once it's dropped in the mailbox. And if you don't know about it and you're asleep at the wheel and not paying attention to what's going on with your station, I think the abbreviation is SOL. Remember, being a licensee or being a responsible party for a licensee means you're being responsible and attentive. It's part of what having a license is. And it's why it's different than, say, what you would do in litigation where they want to make sure you're actually served. It's the basic assumption that as a licensee, you have responsibilities to be paying attention, being in control of your radio station, which means getting mail. Okay.
That's good advice for a lawyer.
All right. Now, this thing about service only works if there's a formal proceeding. So, like, if you filed an application, then an opposition has to be submitted to you, except unless somebody puts a magic word on the top and calls it informal objection. Why? Because an informal objection is petitioning the government, and that's what people can always do. I don't like this programming. I think they're a bunch of commies. I think they're Nazis. You know, whatever it is they want to say, they can say it to a government agency. If it's serious enough, the FCC, based on an informal objection, will serve you with what they call a show cause order or something like that, or a notice of inquiry or a letter of inquiry, where they'd ask you about it. So it's not a formal process. And that's what's probably going to be most of the time, unless you have, say, an application, like if you want to improve your antenna or something like that, or you have a renewal that's coming out. And then there's a formal process where there's 30 days for comments, and then there's 10 days to answer the comments, et cetera, et cetera. Okay? So I give you that as an example, is to try to get an idea of what the procedures are, because you can often win a legal case because somebody had faulty procedure. Let me ask you this. How many of you had competition for your original construction permits? Yeah. And were any of you able to eliminate potential of the other applicants by looking at their procedural problems, forgetting about what they were going to do or who they were? Like, did the wrong person sign it? I had one where we got the channel because we found that the one applicant wasn't qualified because their nonprofit charter from the District of Columbia expired 5 years earlier, and then once we complained about it, they tried to reinstate it. They paid DC a lot of money to reinstate it, but the fact was, the day they applied, they weren't eligible. They were gone. Another one was, it was signed by the office manager of the nonprofit instead of by an officer or a trustee. It was that simple. Yeah.
I've observed that if it's signed by the wrong person,
Well, there's a period for fixing it, but in the case of the LP, you weren't allowed to fix it because that was considered a major modification of that application. There were minor things you could do. It was not considered a technical, like a typo.
Okay, I had a question. Well, actually, I guess it would mean to provide the signature of someone.
Well, that was it, because remember the FCC, because there's not a whole police force, the enforcement bureau is small, it relies on licensees to mainly do the right thing, self-report problems, that's why you have log books, right? And also on the mechanisms of community people plus competitors, whoever they are, whether it's other nonprofits, commercial stations that think they're losing listeners to a non-commercial station, things like that.
Electronic signatures.
Yeah, but if you put down the wrong name, so the electronic signature, that's what I said, it was the office manager. It wasn't an officer of the nonprofit.
What if you signed it with their name? Actually someone else who typed it in.
Well, no, that's it's assumed unless it's fraud, and then you have an affidavit from the officer's name. I didn't authorize them to sign it. This was fraudulent. And then that person who filled it in, you know, there's
the
a federal crime
true.
Involved.
The opposite could be true. I could authorize someone else to sign it for me.
Of course, because you're just...
And that could be an extra.
And that's the same as, like, robo-stamp. You know, in the old days, you had a stamp pad for a check, right? So the clerk... But I want to focus...
Yeah, go ahead.
I like the hypotheticals, but we don't have enough time. I feel like a law school professor. Okay. Can we do the next one? All right, common attack points. These are things to watch out for. And in a lot of cases, because there's not a clear line at all times on some of these, you want to have policies that are comfortable and enforceable given your station governance situation. Obviously, if you're one of the more well-endowed stations and you have a couple of staff members who are monitoring a lot of the output of the volunteers, you know, that's great. But if you're like most LPFMs where everybody's volunteer, you have one very poorly paid person who's got fire in the belly, but, you know, they've got so much to do, the last thing they can't really monitor everything. You need to have policies in place so that if something should happen that you can be attacked on, you can show the FCC that you basically are rule-abiding and this was an aberration, and that can cause the FCC, instead of giving you a fine, which could be $5,000, $10,000, whatever it is, to just admonish you and say, do something different, or asking you to come up with an improvement to your compliance policy, something like that. And that's really important, because without the documentation, the FCC has no way of knowing that you had a system in place to prevent the things that weren't supposed to happen. One of them is indecency. Watch out for this, particularly in pop music. You know, as you probably all know, there's a carve-out time between 6 a.m. and 10 p.m. where you don't want the indecency. The idea is that people should be able to listen to the radio and not worry about their children hearing language they're teaching them not to speak, and, you know, things like that. And, you know, this can come about very often if there is, say, you know, we know that the pop culture has become coarser over the years. So just because something is a number one hit doesn't mean it's clean enough to broadcast before 10 p.m. So you want to have a strong policy about that. And so that if you have a disc jockey who either goofs or intentionally is trying to push the envelope, you have a way to say, you know, you signed this agreement, these are our rules here, we got to protect the license, we understand about expression and artistry and everything else, but we got a radio license to protect. And if this happens again, you're gone. Or whatever it is your policy is. But you want to be able to show that to the FCC. Because it probably will happen. I mean, we also know sometimes it happens involuntarily. Somebody thinks the mics are closed, and they drop a couple of F-bombs, thinking they're just chatting with the host. Oh, and guess what? The mic's open. Yeah? Well, as a lawyer, I would recommend not tampering with evidence. Because then you get into worse trouble. That could be a federal crime for whoever erased that tape, okay? Now, especially if you have, I mean, I do recommend stations have a retention policy. You know, it's cheap enough now to save audio. It's not like the old days where you had expensive recording tape and needed huge rooms, you know? This cloud can hold a lot of stuff, especially for radio, because it's pretty lean, unlike video. You know, in terms of scripts, I also recommend keeping scripts for at least 2 years, and best practice is to keep all that archival stuff until after you get your next renewal, because a lot of times this stuff comes up at renewal. Somebody's keeping a file on you. Your permanent file, right? Remember those?
Yeah.
And And then when your license comes up for renewal, if they know enough about the process, that's when they start to give you heartburn. And they've collected all this stuff, and they try to get the FCC to believe that you are not fit to be a trustee of this public resource. And I don't want to exaggerate that in terms of the chance that they'll succeed, because it's very hard to succeed at that. But what it can do is hold your license renewal for a long time until the FCC has solved all the issues and can find staff with time to write an opinion. And often it's FCC resources that slow things down rather than anything else. And you may not be able, for instance, to get an upgrade grant until your license is renewed. Or if, let's say, you want to change the ownership of the station to a different nonprofit for whatever reason, that's not going to happen until after you renew. And so there's a whole bunch of back-end stuff that can screw up a lot of your planning and your enterprise activities. Yeah?
We're subject to a voluntary timeshare agreement. We haven't started our partners out. They're supposed to get off at 4 p.m. recently, and they normally get off at 4:03 or 4:04, so that they've exceeded the time. But 2 weeks ago, between 4 p.m. and 4:03 p.m., they put a song that had MF 25 times. And so, you know, I mean, we haven't started yet, but it's...
Well, you have proof that since you're not on the air,
right,
and you're not program testing, that if the complaint were against you instead of the other station, it wasn't us. And the main thing is just to be prepared to write that letter to the FCC.
Should I document? Because I take part of it, but I mostly took notes.
Well, a tape is certainly better, although, you know, it depends whether you want to get into a fight, because that's the kind of thing that I'm explaining how to defend yourself for. And, you know, it's probably better tactically, unless you're already at war with these guys. You know, I might, if you're friendly enough, just pick up the phone and say to the station manager, listen, I'm not going to comment on what you do the rest of the day, but during this period until we get on the air, why don't you keep the foul language off of what we might be blamed for, because we just don't have time to sit around and answer complaints or letters of inquiry from the FCC. It just, you know, and they might actually not even realize it, because again, we know what running community radio station is. If this jockey who's got one air shift a week, you know, is an artist who wants to express themselves. That's what's beautiful about what we do. On the other hand, you know, people who do this kind of stuff are often boundary pushers, and certain boundaries are hard to push because they can harm everyone, right? And that harms you. So I would probably take it privately, would be my tactical recommendation. But just make sure that you have stuff ready if the FCC asks you, if somebody complains and blames you, say, hey, we're not even on the air here. And here's the reason. Look, we haven't filed our license application. We haven't started programming. So that's it. All right, interference. Now, interference complaints are often subjective, and they can be manipulated very easily. How are they manipulated? Let's say you're second adjacent, as many of us are, to a commercial station, and there's an area where they're not entitled to protection, but they liked it better before you were there because they had listeners there, right? I mean, we all understand that. And they try to game the system. So the mother of the station manager, the commercial station, files an interference complaint. You want to track the whole line of relationships as best you can. You also want to look, again, procedure is your friend if this happens. And I choose these because they're things that happen a lot. Sworn listener statement has to include a name and some kind of address for the person, preferably a home address, but could be a work address, because they have to be a bona fide living human being, not a Joe Smith who was made up in order to file this. They have to say that they regularly listen to this other station, and as of a certain date or time or something, you know, it could be vague, like around Christmas, I couldn't hear it anymore. And the implication being, you know, you just turned your station on the week before Christmas. So, and they need to give details of listening. Do they listen in the car? Do they listen at home? Listen at the office? And so you want to look very closely at those, because a lot of times if they haven't identified a bona fide listener that is verifiable, that doesn't have some official role with the other station, you know, an ownership role, a management role, even just a plain old job could be the receptionist. And you also have the right to contact that person and try to remediate it, because sometimes interference is because somebody bought a $5 radio at the dollar store.
Or a thousand.
Yeah. And they have, there's no selectivity. I mean, it's no better than having a wide crystal that picks up the entire FM band. I mean, and if that's the case, you can go out and buy them a nice Sony, say here. And for $50, you've gotten rid of it, because you can go there to that address, turn it on and say, look, here's a radio with better selectivity. Go put it in your kitchen and listen to your station. Leave us alone, okay? So you gotta figure out what those things are, but if they don't give that information, you can't fix the interference. And you can just respond saying, they have all these names, they don't say who these people, give us any way to identify this as a real person, nor does it say where they were listening. How do I know they weren't trying to listen from Philadelphia to my radio station in Pittsburgh, right? All right, so you wanna make sure things are in the sort of right form like that.
Are they going to complain directly to the FCC, or are they going to complain first to the station?
Depends. Genuine listener might complain to you, or they might make a complaint, say, to the Enforcement Bureau. If you go to the FCC, you'll have a link for a complaint, and that'll go to the Enforcement Bureau. But what happens, I mean, I'm involved in one of these now in the D.C. area. We've got an LPFM that's suddenly being impinged by a cross service FM translator for an AM station. That's an AM translator on FM. They call it cross service because traditionally FM translators were for FM stations. And so so I gathered these declarations, these sworn statements from listeners, and tried to follow this format. Specifically, you know, that was using it offensively, so they couldn't do this to us. Now, obviously, if everybody could afford a lawyer, it doesn't have to be me, there are lots of good lawyers out there, but, you know, understanding how LPFMs are, you got to do some self-help here. So just familiarizing yourself with the things that are required, so you can just answer an interference complaint that the station sends to the FCC with these declarations. They're like affidavits without AM. Yeah.
What about one of your listeners who is within your coverage contour and they hear the other station?
Well, that's the same thing. I'm just talking about...
You complain against them, though.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm describing.
They would have to fix that for that listener who should be able to hear...
Theoretically. I mean, the FCC has to verify it, which is why you want to have multiple. You don't want to have a single one. Because it could be he doesn't get it because he's got an old building that has like a lead wall somewhere and it's facing your transmitter and he's not going to get through that, so he gets the radio station on the other side. That's not an interference problem per se. Or again, if it's the $5 radio, you give him a nice radio. You know, it's like that. All right. So that's being aware of that can be really helpful because you can sometimes push back a lot of garbage because people don't necessarily follow these rules. Faulty operations. That'll
often. Time limit on that, like if you're a new station, is there a time limit, you know, in which they have to complain about interference, or is this something?
Well, there are different types of interference, so yeah, I don't want to go too deep into the tech rules, but the contour protection, which is what for? Well, I mean, I assume as a lot of you are in management, so you at least understand when I talk about 60 dBU contour. And for an LP, you get protection, full protection in your 60 dBU contour against anything that comes later. And so whatever that particular protection is for that type of station is what people are entitled to. And it varies. And there are other kinds of interference, like what's called blanketing interference. That has a limit of a year after you've turned on your station. Blanketing interference is the kind of thing that happens when you live in the neighborhood of a radio station, you open your refrigerator, and you start hearing pop music.
That's an extra feature in a lot of refrigerators.
There you go. Pick up your telephone, you know. I mean, they're supposed to be on a different frequency, but they're just, there's such a bunch of electrons. And then that new the station that just put in the new antenna and transmitter is going to have to fix that. But that's only within a year. You have a year for that. Now, those are different types. What I mean by different types of interference. But the interference within a protected contour area, there's no limit. Because imagine somebody was a year later, and then you say, okay, let's start, change our engineering and start messing with these guys. You know, that would be the reason. Other things to look for that commonly happen, and I think this may overlap a little bit with what Donna just did, so for those of you who sat through that, I appreciate your patience. If you've heard all that before, look at your antenna site, and if it's properly fenced off, if that's required, and it has to be properly posted with warning signs and so forth, and a contact number, and all of that stuff. Make sure all of those things happen. Because if somebody's looking to get you, one of the things they're going to do is try to inspect your antenna site and make sure you're following all the safety regulations, okay? So that's just general good practice. But especially when you know, maybe instead of going every week or every month to inspect, if you know you're in somebody's crosshairs, just start doing it more often, because you don't want to, that's the kind of thing that is a, you know, it's a real fault, and it's there for safety reasons, but you want to make sure it's not used just to harass you, okay? Obviously, you know, don't overpower. If you're having to turn down your power, having a technical problem, make sure it's properly logged. After 10 days of silent or reduced power operation, you've got to inform the FCC. And after 30 days, you have to apply for special temporary authority, which allows you, say, to be silent or to operate at variance with your authorized parameters, as they say in lawyers. In other words, if you're operating differently than your license says, right? So remember those deadlines, because people can attack you on that stuff, you know? And so you want to watch for those things. So, you know, that's all part of having a regular compliance program, but all the more so if you think you're in crosshairs, go back and check and make sure all your systems are working like they're supposed to. Make sure that this isn't the 11th day and you haven't notified the FCC that you're silent. You know, and one way you can do it is when you hit 10 days, since you're non-commercial stations and you don't pay fees to file for special temporary authority, you hit day 10 or day 9, whatever it is, and you think it might last a little longer, that you're silent or you're lower power operation, just apply for the STA then. You don't have to wait 30 days to apply. Just do it. And if you get back up to full power, then you notify the FCC that you're back at full power. But it takes almost the same amount of work to file the STA as the notice. So I would make the STA the default. Yeah.
What if you didn't file?
Fix it as soon as you can. And be prepared for it to be an issue at your renewal. And keep records so that, you know, if it's the beginning of your 8-year license term, whoever might be managing the station at the next license renewal has enough information to be able to answer for it. Because you actually have to disclose stuff like that on your renewal application. It's not a deal killer. It's part of self-regulatory assessment. Okay?
How agency, is that all just, are they set up for?
Yeah, the online CDBS system, which is slowly, it's already phased out for television, to be phased out for radio, to the licensing management system. But I assume most people who are station managers have some familiarity with CDBS, the consolidated database system, and have filed in it, or whoever does the filing for you, it may be an engineer or a lawyer, you know, they should do it, but it's not a bad idea to learn your way around it, because sometimes you don't want to pay somebody to file for you if it's something simple you can do, like notifying the FCC that you've been silent for 9 days, and, you know, something like that. Okay? Another thing that sometimes people forget, especially LPs, you have a fairly modest antenna array that's really kind of portable, and the rooftop you're on is being knocked down, and the guy halfway down the block says, yeah, you can put it up here. Guess what? Don't forget to file an application, because the FCC, it's a different place, that's a serious violation. And you know that if somebody has you in their crosshairs and they know the rules, they're gonna say, look, there's nothing but an empty lot here. How do they say that they have their antenna here? Where are they operating from? They send a picture to the FCC. You got trouble. So try to be attentive to that. Even if it seems like, oh, we're talking about 150 yards, it's enough. It's not where you say it is. Make the application. Chances are it's not going to be a big deal to get it approved. You know, you still have to worry about things like historic preservation rules and environmental rules. But, you know, whoever does your engineering work for that stuff will know that and will get you through it. Okay? And the biggest thing of all, which is why I capitalized it, the FCC requires you have logs, so that everything that's operationally problematic, whether it's, you know, a 4-hour silent outage, overpowering, a curse word that accidentally got on the air, and any number of other things, is there if they ask questions. And again, it makes sense, because the volunteers or the paid manager can change 4 years later and the FCC wants to know this. So you're required to log it. Make sure your logs are right. Make sure the air people who are primarily there for, you know, artistic, political, literary, whatever type of expression, they understand that with this platform comes this responsibility to log this stuff when it happens, or at least tell the station manager so the station manager logs it, or the chief engineer, however you're set up for it.
Your enemies, they're like allowed to look at the logs?
Not necessarily, but they'll know if something happens. If you're silent, your enemy is going to know you're silent.
But can anybody look at the logs? Can Joe Blow walk up the street?
No.
Okay. So the engineer at the closest station couldn't say, anybody look at your logs? Oh, look at all these problems.
No, but well, where it is, and I'm assuming we're talking low power. Has anybody got a full power non-com here? Well, yeah, Jim. Jim's got everything. So with LPs, remember that you don't even have to have a public file for anybody to inspect. And so that's where a lot of stuff goes. And so the public really doesn't have a right to walk into your station during business hours and demand to see records. Okay? And so that's one of the things. But, believe me, you know, something that's serious, like, you know, indecent language in the kids' time, you know, in the non-carve-out time during, you know, after 10 p.m. before 6 a.m., or station going silent, if somebody's out to get you, they just mark this stuff down. Do it in the form of an affidavit. Now, it's true people do commit perjury, but the assumption is until you show somebody to be lying, an affidavit is considered, since it's sworn testimony under oath with criminal penalties for perjury, to be real evidence. And so somebody swears out an affidavit or the FCC version called a declaration, says they were off the air at this time, you know, or they've been off the air for 15 days. And the FCC asks and looks and says, you haven't notified us, right? Something like that. Or 30 days, well, they're still silent, there's no special temporary authority. So those are things. But good practice is to have a policy in place. Yeah, everybody makes mistakes. Everybody, you know, we hope people won't destroy evidence. But people do that too. They cover up, they hide stuff. But generally, having a good compliance policy shows that you're a good actor, and it makes the FCC more well-disposed simply because they don't have cops on the team. I mean,
there was a serious violations, media violations somewhere.
I mean, yeah, you can look at the forfeiture guidelines, they're called. Forfeiture is FCC speak for a fine. And you can see what the forfeiture range is for certain things, and the ones that have the highest fines are considered the most serious.
Is there a law template that you recommend?
Not in particular, but I bet you among this group or, you know, on the email list, like the GRC email list or the NFCB email list, you can ask and people will do it. It tends to be engineers are often good at pop. Pablito, you have one that you recommend for people?
Would you prefer a
lock?
I mean, yeah, Sharon.
My question was, can you list what would be the operational issues that we should be logging? I mean, we've got the transmitter. So you do recommend logging if someone compresses on the air?
I probably would. Just because if it's part of a compliance policy, you know, and it might be because if you've invested, say, in a 7-second delay device, let's just say the 7-second delay malfunctioned because the computer needed to be rebooted. You know, you're shown as a better actor, for instance, in that case, than if you have no 7-second delay. The FCC will cut you slack. So you would log in, you know, F-bomb by host, confused by lack of open microphone, and digital delay mechanism rebooted due to power surge. And then, you know, you have it, and it shows you're doing the right things at the FCC. Yep. Exactly. Right, it may be, but it, you know, again, having a 7-second delay is a better deal. You're better off, if you can afford it, to have it in place and then attribute it to human error or technical malfunction when it doesn't catch it. I mean, there was that famous thing where somebody went off and cursed and then cursed again, so the first curse got caught, but while the 7-second delay was resetting, the second curse word went out. Okay? So, you know, yeah.
And so, okay, so besides the transmitter and logging potential facilities, what would be any other things that we should log?
Emergency alert box, not working or out of service, restored service.
Yeah, overpowering or even report of a fencing problem around your antenna and then note what you did. It was reported that a truck had knocked over the fence and station manager visited site and ordered repairs. Completed, you know, 2 days later. Something like that. Yeah?
I just want to include, we early on had a lot of issues with our transmitter. Our transmitter is like 2 blocks away. So we, any time the transmitter would knock our broadcast signal off, we block that as well.
Yeah.
Because sometimes it would take us a couple hours to get over.
Right.
We have a lot of red tape for access because we're part of the...
Right. And that
could
be...
That's where our transmitter is, so it's great resolve of transmitter issues, but we log those because it would just completely
out of software. Can you use your transmitter logs? And should you maybe take your transmitter log, the internal one, and just copy it and then make your own logs if you haven't done it to clarify all of the problems on the transmitter? Because won't they get the logs from the transmitter? And if it doesn't match...
Are you talking about the digitally created ones that the transmitter does automatically?
It does,
I mean, that's one way to do it, but remember it needs to be signed, essentially certified by somebody who is in charge, a chief operator, somebody like that, and whoever's making the entry. So,
but I mean, those don't match. If your wedding signature one doesn't match the logs over here, wouldn't that be a big, whoa, what are you doing?
Well, possibly, so you probably want to update it because it's information about your operation. Yeah. So if you have information, I mean, it can happen that you're on automation, everybody's out on the Appalachian Trail again.
Yeah.
Since we're near the Adirondacks, I'll use that. And nobody's there, and you come back Monday morning from a long weekend retreat with management in the woods, and you find the station's knocked off the air, so you go to the electronic logs to see what was happening, and then, you know, you report what you report. You take information as it becomes available to you. Would you agree, Pablito, because on the technical end, as an engineer?
Normally they wouldn't do that. The log that the transmitter keeps signed, be an adequate log?
Yes, theoretically, yes.
Unsigned simply means...
If somebody has reviewed it and certified it as accurate.
Right.
Okay, yes. If you want to put it outside.
Yeah.
You have to do that at any particular interval, or you can do that when the people arrive.
Yes, the closest to the event is possible, so it was contemporaneous.
Yeah, I mean, they don't, you know, the thing is that the general rule of evidence is, as we all know, that people's memories fade or change as there's new stimuli. So the closer to the event, the truer it is, right? That's the idea. And that's why, like in law in general, there are statutes of limitations sometimes, because, you know, 20 years later, witnesses have had a lot of inputs. And so, you know, so that's sort of how to understand why you want to do it as contemporaneously as possible. Maybe you don't get the input because you don't know that there's an intermittent outage that's, you know, that's half an hour in the middle of the night because everybody who would be paying attention to that is sleeping, so you find out in the morning. But then that would at least be contemporaneous as you found out about it. Same thing with, say, logging a fencing or a lighting problem at the transmitter, right?
So that would be your guess.
Yeah.
So I could log. I went to a seminar. I didn't quite understand my logging problems in my log. And now I'm going to update my logs today. And I'm going to try.
From this day on,
I'm going to do a better person. And here's some of the logs I'm trying to fix the best.
I mean, if you want to, it depends. That's the thing is that you go back and you put in the new log information. You make a notation, what was the situation?
Okay.
So we got a data dump from our transmitter supplier who provided new software that allowed us to provide greater detail, or whatever it is. Just it's there so that you can show that you're operating responsibly. You know? And the more you can show that, the better your situation will be if you get attacked either for wrong reasons like politics or spite, or for right reasons because you're operating like a rogue. Okay?
And people are likely to wait 8 years before they make noise about it, or you're more likely to hear it?
Well, the thing is, there's a formal process at license renewal, which allows for people to cause havoc. Well, you can complain to the FCC at any time, you can state your opinion, petition the government anytime. There is a formal window, assuming you're not upgrading in between or you're not you don't have a new board that you need to have the FCC approve, or selling the station to another nonprofit. There's a window every time your license is renewed for public comment and very formal process. Sort of the same thing that would be, like, say, when there's a new rule coming in. You know, when they finally have a formal rule making to get rid of, say, local public files for commercial stations, which is in the works, the people will have a chance within a 30-day period to comment, and then another period to reply to the comments. And in that formal process, if there's enough on the record, it slows down your renewal. So that's why sometimes people keep records and then attack you with the renewal, because it can really screw up what's happening going forward. If there's enough there that people can raise in allegations, it might take the FCC 3-4 years to renew your station. And in that period, you know, you're not going to be able to do much in the way of upgrades. You're not going to be able to sell the station to another nonprofit or reorganize into a new, you know, sometimes there's a reorganization. People who teamed up to get an LPFM with an old nonprofit, and the old nonprofit may want to go back to its core mission and spin it off. All of that stuff could be hindered until you get your renewal, because it'll just put everything in a freeze. Any more on this stuff in this slide?
I was wondering if you have to keep a printout of your EAS slots if you're getting them sent to you electronically from your machine. Do you know if you have to print those out?
I don't think so.
But that's part of your reporting requirement. That's what those EAS reports are for.
But he's asking you have to print out the electronic log that's in the machine. Or print out the emails that you get from the machine.
You know, I have to go and look a little more closely at that rule, because
we don't print ours out, we just leave them in the machine and log into the machine and see what the history
is. Yeah. The main thing is that you have document retention. So however it is, you can have it. One of the problems with the AS machines is since every couple of years the FCC changes the software and sometimes you have to buy a new device, then you want to have a document retention program to show compliance. And especially with the AS, because that's one of the core public service features that everybody has to do regardless of politics or commercial interests, right? Because that's national security, safety, all those other things. So that would be my advice. But Sharon, we can look up some... Sharon, we can check something specifically. That's so specific in terms of best practices that I would rather not spit it off the top of my head. The thing is you do need to retain those records to show compliance. And you do have to file reports.
Right. We're doing all that, just I wasn't sure if we actually had to do
it. When you have an outage, you put it, so if suddenly the software crashes, that you lock for sure. And then when you get it back online, and if you need a waiver for a short period because you need to order a new machine, you can't fix it or whatever it is, then you have to take the proper steps. Yeah. Okay, let's go to the last slide. Go to the next slide. Where we go. All right. Political things, obviously everybody's got trouble. Everybody understands. Let me ask, does anybody not have any questions about the political rules and what you have to do and what equal access means?
If you don't have questions, you probably need to find some questions. Because it's complicated.
Yeah.
Quick question. Can a station manager run for office and then remain the manager?
Potentially, as long as they're not on the air, but it may be a bad practice because you may make the station, and this is a business question more than a legal question,
sure,
but the person better not be on the air.
Okay, very good.
Okay? It's like Ronald Reagan's movie Bedtime for Bonzo. Could not be on the air, even though it was about a man and his chimp, right? And he was running. That was it. Okay? All right. Equal opportunity, if it's news and public affairs, and that includes things, like on a national level, when newsmakers, politicians, office holders appear on the Tonight Show or something, that is considered news and public affairs, even though it's an entertainment program, ostensibly, because it's widely used, okay? So what you have to worry about is stuff like a disc jockey who's running for office and doesn't tell you, and then comes on the air, suddenly everybody who's running against him is going to be entitled to an equal opportunity. It's not the exact amount of time. It's negotiable. It's what's equivalent time. So when you have 20 listeners at 4 a.m. on Tuesday morning, it's going to be less valuable time than at 8 a.m. where everybody's in their cars and you've got hundreds of listeners, right? So remember, it's not equal time these days. It's equal opportunity. It only applies for candidates running for office, nothing else, okay?
Do you have to notify them, or do they have to?
No, they have to notify you. I mean, it's not bad to say this happened, would you like time? But that's just to make people less apt to attack you. As I said, mindful of air talent, anybody on the air running for office, whether it's newscaster, disc jockey, a poet, whatever show you've got. You know, they're running, they're off the air, unless you're covering them as a candidate in some news and public affairs context. Okay? Again, bedtime for Bonzo, no chips. Okay?
So all right. Basically, as long as you're not, like, selling, like, underwriting spots, you can interview whatever candidate.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm saying you cover them as any other candidate, but take away their disc jockey slot till the election's over.
Well, no, I mean, we don't have any volunteers running for anything. That's not
so
it's impossible. Well, we interview a lot of Green Party people.
Perfect.
And people have tried to tell us, oh, like, think of the other candidates.
No, it's news and public affairs.
No, actually.
You're not interviewing the Green Party candidate about the person's folk song repertoire, right? It's about politics.
Right.
News. You're fine.
Right. If there are news shows.
Yeah.
It gets slippery when you've got a music show that never has guests, and they bring in the Green Party candidate.
Yeah, good point.
Right, and then the problem is, since it's not a program that regularly has a news and public affairs component, that's why I use The Tonight Show, because they're appearing on there all the time, or on Saturday Night Live, right? Even Saturday Night Live, they satire themselves. But that's okay, because that's regular. But suddenly, if, you know, out of the blue, disc jockey brings in a candidate and doesn't do it ever, and isn't doing it for the whole election season, you got trouble. So you want to watch out for these one-off things, which kind of become an opportunity that shouldn't be. But so you want to have some guidelines for what constitutes bona fide within your context, right? What's a bona fide news public affairs show? Okay. I'm rushing just because we're almost out of time. All right. Commercials masquerading as underwriting announcements. Anybody was at my thing yesterday, that's all about that. I'm not going to go through it again, but I'm glad if you email me to provide you, if you don't have the paper copies of either presentation, I'll email you on request a copy that you can have, okay? Next.
I have a question. I'm sorry. But if you have someone on air talking about their business as a guest, is that okay, or is that considered a
problem? It depends on the context. If you have, like, a show about local entrepreneurs, then that's kind of in a news context, so that's in the exclusion. If the guy is just coming on because his buddy has the next slot and is chatting about his nightclub or his herbal remedy shop.
So
or
something. Music Fest is coming up tomorrow and they try to spin the whole show and talk about
that. You want to watch out for that, because the problem is remember the payola plugola distinction, right? And so it may be plugola. I mean, that's sort of, you know, contextual. Yeah, okay. And I'll talk to you. I can give you more later. All right, let's go to the next. Avoid self-inflicted injury. All right? Broadcast regulations, it's clear, this is from the FCC's own words, rests upon the assumption that applicants will supply the commission with accurate information, self-policing, okay? And statements have to be made with a reasonable basis. So just because you don't, you better check and make sure you have facts to back up what you're saying, because it may not be considered a lie, which is misrepresentation in FCC speak, but it could be a lack of candor, because you just say, you know how people just deny stuff without checking just because they think it'll be bad for them if they admit it? Don't do that. Okay? Don't hide the ball, right? And the reason is, because of the need for self-policing, the FCC will forgive many things, but it's unlikely to forgive misleading statements, manipulation of facts, outright lies, et cetera, et cetera. And attackers know this, and they're going to try to get you on them. If they're out to get you, you know, they're going to look for discrepancies that you should have been able to identify yourself, or that where you contradict yourself. So watch out. Next. All right, and sometimes there's really going to be an issue. You know, we're all human, we make mistakes, volunteer operations, a lot of egos, a lot of, you know, people who need more training and not enough ability for people who are managing the enterprise. So anyway, I give you these as, since we got 2 minutes, I'm not going to read them all to you, but remember, you can ask the FCC to settle if it's really bad. That's consent agreement. And then afterwards, if you think you really are in the right and you were wrongly fined, there's three steps to appeals, and that explains it there, and I'll let you read more about it just because we're running out of time. So the last, get yourselves a copy of this. Keep it around the station. Keep multiple copies. Put it on the doorposts of your house and upon your gates. And, you know, look for, like, Michi took this and riffed on it and expanded it, which is not a bad thing to have from RecNets, and there are other guides like that. But definitely, this is almost like a checklist. Go through this and make sure you're compliant.
This answers the EAS question.
Yep.
Can we
give us a demo on an insight what Fuller did that's the self-expected?
It's a good one, although it's a little out of, is it updated?
It's,
is it fresh?
Yeah.
Well, then I'm sorry I didn't plug yours as well,
Okay, so have a Bill the Mouse shows that you're trying to do something right here.
Well, it also shows, yeah, you make that, but more than filling it out and checking the boxes, it also says, God, I forgot about it. You know? It's just like you got to check. It's like the 20-point checklist when you, you know, you go get your car, your oil change. The guy also checks the brakes and the air filter. You know, that's all it is. Okay? I'm a Brown, so we can continue at lunch. I'll answer questions. I'm leaving at by like 1 o'clock, so please feel free, okay?
Thank you.
And my cards are on the table. Feel free. Not necessarily to give you business. I hope none of you need to call a lawyer, but if you need any of my presentations, we didn't have enough printouts. And Al, will there be a compilation from
somehow we'll set up something. Whatever.